Quick morning, or good afternoon, everybody, although it's still halachically morning. This is a new topic, so you have to bear with me a little bit. I've been trying to think about, you know, what took place in the United States over the last little while, and I'm not interested in a political discussion, because I don't think that's very fruitful, but I was thinking a lot about, and there's been a lot of information that's been out there, on how do you deal with rumors? What's the role of rumors in Jewish law? How do we respond? How do we respond to rumors and to allegations? Number one, two. How much evidence do we need, right? And that's obviously connected to rumors. Right? How much evidence? What's considered evidence in terms of, you know, prosecution? And number three, when we talk about appointment of communal leaders, so what should be the standard? Should we have a higher standard, lower standard, regular standard? What should be the standard for communal leaders? Next. How much we care about what someone did 30, 40, 50 years ago? Why is that relevant? Why does it even matter? And on the same vein, is there what's called a statute of limitations in Jewish law? And the last issue, which is I think is very important, how do we deal with evidence that's not 100% halachic? I'm going to explain what I mean by that. We know that according to the Torah, you need two witnesses. The Torah says, Al pi shnei edim yukum davar. You need two witnesses. But well, I don't have two witnesses. I only have one witness. What do I do? Or two relatives can't testify in court. Even Moses and Aaron can't testify together. I don't care how righteous they are. They're not allowed to testify. So how do we deal with accepting and dealing with their testimony? A woman, according to the Torah, can't testify. How do we deal with women's testimony? And these are major issues. Major issues. You should know that there's a famous Drashot Aran in the 12th century who said, if we have to hold by all the strict evidence, according to the Torah, we'll never be able to convict anybody. And especially because today, we're not convicting anybody of a capital offense. We're not putting anyone to death. So already, there's no death penalty in Canada. There's no death penalty anymore in Jewish law. Yeah. So therefore, how do we deal with... I know testimony about a person. I don't testify. I see something derogatory, repugnant, perhaps even in the sexual nature, and I don't see anything. Also, that is a third thing that Hashem despises. And you testify individually as a singular person. Why is that a problem? Because a single person can't testify. You need two witnesses. And the case the Gemara gives is the following: Ki hai detuv yachata, va'ata zigud luchude, va'as hidbe kame to Rav Papa. The case is the following: This is a well-known case. A guy called Tuvia did something. He sinned. He did something immoral. Zigud came and saw what he did. He runs to Rav Papa and says, "Rav Papa, I saw Tuvia sin." Tuvia did something disgusting. What did Rav Papa say? Nigdei lezigud. Rav Papa says, go take out the belt and go give lashes to Zigud. He says, Tuvia chatav zigud minigud? What? I did nothing wrong. Why are you punishing me? I'm just coming to testify. What do you want from me? I saw this guy do something terrible, horrific, disgusting, debaseful, and I'm getting punished? That's chutzpah, that's brazen. Answer. Yes, I'm all going to eat. Rav Papa says, yes, you're being punished. Why? Dichsiv lo yakum eid echad b'ish. A testimony of one person cannot withstand court. Va'at l'chutcha sadit be. And you got up, and you went to court, and you testified against this person. Shem ra be'alma kamafgid lei. All you did was give him a bad reputation. That's the end of the story. So, we see here a case of one person witnessing something, runs to court, and he gets flogged because he, what's called, violated this principle of Moti Shemra, he besmirched someone's reputation. Yes?
What if he thought that someone else would come testify too?
That's a great case. It's a very good question. What about maybe George also saw it, and maybe George was going to show up soon. Okay, great. Even more fundamental question is, suppose he doesn't do nothing?
Yeah.
Now, let's assume he actually sees this, which is what the Gemara is assuming. The guy actually sees it. Why did Rav Papa Why didn't he just say, you know, okay, how did you respond? What, the person who does something wrong in front of one person gets to walk the streets? Gets to become perceived in an illustrious position in government, in court? What's going on here? How are you supposed to deal with this? Okay. That's like the base case that everyone kind of talks about in when it comes to individuals doing something which is totally inappropriate in this act. But that's the... Now, as we know, so here's the Kavanaugh case, and again, just to give you a little bit of background in case people aren't familiar. So literally, it was right before he was about to be elected to the Supreme Court. I think it was about even the night before. Comes along...
It was a week before the vote.
A week before the vote. Basically, you know, and all of a sudden says, this guy did something inappropriate to me 35 years ago.
When we were 15.
When we were 15, back in high school.
Maybe 15.
Now, here's what's fascinating about this case. First of all, that's why I mentioned statute of limitations. That's number one. Number two, one person.
She's not even a witness.
She's a victim. So the question is, can a victim also become witness? It's very possible they can in this case. It's not good. Good point. Number three, evidence. Number four. Now, did Kavanaugh only appear on the scene now?
What do you mean?
I mean, Kavanaugh has been involved in politics.
He's been a judge.
He was a judge for a very long time. He had a very reputation.
That's not political.
So all of a sudden, he's receiving a political position, and all of a sudden, she pipes out. So that led to people, like, what's going on? Is there a motive? Okay. Anything else? That's basically the background information that's kind of needed. So what I want to do, in order to kind of find a reference point in Jewish law, there's different types of leadership in Jewish law that are spoken about in great detail. Believe it or not, this is going to be a little bit shocking, but a chazen, a person who actually leads the services, and I don't just mean on high holidays, I actually mean on a Tuesday, is actually considered a very prestigious position. Other types of communal positions are looked upon very seriously in Judaism. I don't know if I should send this to like UJ Federation, but just communal positions are looked upon very seriously. To show you how serious they are, I want to show you the status of communal leaders. So it's in Hebrew, I will translate. The Darche Moshe, who's the Ramah, Rav Moshe Israel, who lived in Krakow in the 16th century, commentary, the Choshen Mishpat, writes, what's the name of the Maria? And he says, Tove HaKahal is a leadership position. HaMemunim LaAsok B'Tzorchei Tzibur, who have been appointed to do with communal affairs, or the Yechidim, or individual affairs. Meaning, if it doesn't matter if it's communal or individual, maybe they deal with individuals, or they deal with people, or communities. HaRehen KiDayanim, you have the status of judges. Now, why? Because if I'm the community, I'm deciding where money's going and where money's coming, right? That's what UGA does. Or I'm deciding establishments, I'm deciding communal norms, I'm deciding about maybe kashrut responsibilities or synagogue responsibilities. That's a communal position. Vasur lohoshiv b'neihem misha paso ledin. You're not allowed to give them a position. Just like you're not allowed to appoint a judge. Meaning, they're of the same barometer as a judge. Anytime there's a person who's being questioned of wickedness, they cannot be appointed a judge. They also cannot have these communal positions. So that's a very powerful statement. Right? So you might think, oh yeah, judge, that's a real prestigious position. But all I do is work for Hillel. No! The answer is working in a communal position. Maybe you're dealing with funds and the personal things, for sure, of course, being a rabbi. Very serious. Yeah.
So does it just say someone who's been accused of something like this can't be?
Okay, very good. So you're asking so what does it mean, Mishum Risha? Very good. What does it mean because of some type of wickedness? What's the barometer there? Question number two is, and this is also what's fascinating, is this pre or post facto? Right? Meaning, if the person has a position, do you remove such a person? Or do we hire such a person? Okay, good. That's awesome. Very important. Versus pre and post facto. The language here seems to say, they can't even have among them someone who has Risha. So, and the Shulchan Aruch, in the next source, in quoted Jewish law, codifies the Darchei Moshe basically verbatim. And that's, in fact, what appears to be the same. So that's the number. So the question is, what's the rule of a judge? So take a look at this. This is found in the laws of Tshuva, Hilchot Tshuva. Levichach, listen to this. I'll read the English for this one. Is there an extra point over each and every community in Israel, a great scholar of mature age, God-fearing since his early youth, and loved by them, people, to preach to the public and to turn them to repent? But he who despises criticism does not come to hear the preacher and does not pay attention to his words. He therefore holds on to his sin, which to his eyes appear to be good. Meaning, you have to learn to listen that you're not perfect. But more importantly, from our perspective, in order to become a judge, a communal position, you need to be able to, from the time of your youth, be God-fearing. So the commentators are like, what is, are you kidding me? From the time that you're 12 years old, you need... We'll get there. Let's continue. Beit Din Shel Shoshla, a court of three. Avishim Medaktim him. So we know there's different kinds of courts in Jerusalem. There's a court of three, there's a court of 23, and a court of 70. 70, 71. And we know a court of three, we can't be too stringent. You know why? Because if we're too stringent about judges, nothing will ever happen. It'll be caught up in political hogwash, and it won't be very helpful. So we're not that strict who we appoint as a judge of three, because we want to get monetary and civil court cases completed. So we're not that strict. But this is funny. We're not that strict. So all they have to be is the following. Chachma, they have knowledge, wisdom, humility, reverence, disdain of grain, love of truth, love of my fellow man, and good reputation. That's all. We're not going to be so strict. Right? Just these seven things.
But no, what you'd want to, like, the basic quality, you'd want to, like, any judge? Or, like, literally anybody?
So, okay, so as we're saying, a court of three, we got to fill these positions. So we're only going to have these seven standards, which, by the way, seem to be very high. I mean, think about this, right? Humility, wisdom, reverence, disdain of gain, can't be out there for the money. How exactly you measure these things, how you judge them is obviously quite complicated.
Like how high they have to be in the thing? Do they have to be like exemplary in anything, or do they have to be, you know, smarter than
above
average?
Above average.
Above average.
Above average in your humility.
Right? Because it's a pretty big difference.
It's a very good question. The standard is going to be quite serious. Meaning, if I could prove that you don't love truth, then you can't be a judge.
But what if you can prove that he only loves truth a little bit more than most people?
That would be a problem. No, I don't believe this is. I think it has to be, you have to show that you always have truth, right? Right? It's not necessarily everybody else. Now, this question became very, shall we say, there were cases, I know this sounds shocking, where various rabbinic figures were sometimes had questionable youths or questionable backgrounds, and all of a sudden, they were potentially given these positions.
Like that famous example of the Reish Lakish?
So the Reish Lakish...
Was he like a thief or something?
He was a bandit. He was a bandit. The difference with Reish Lakish was that... I don't know if he had his own community. He might just have been...
Just a rabbi or...
A scholar in the Beis Medrash. Because he never had a Rebbe. Usually he didn't have like his own yeshiva. But that's about to be very good. That's a very good... It's an excellent question, Adam. So this question was posed to a guy who, when he was younger, was thrown into jail for tax evasion, and now he was just about to be appointed rabbi of a very large shul. And he asks, do I have to tell my congregation, you should know I served time 30 years ago. Is he obligated, and is he able to become a rabbi of the community? Or does it disqualify him because of what he did 30 years ago that he spent time for? So the answer was given was very simple. You're not obligated to tell them because you've done tshuva. You've repented. You did your time. You paid the government back. Are you sincerely remorseful? I'm remorseful for what I did. Now, if they ask you, sometimes some questionnaires, you know, did he ever serve time in jail? That's a difference. You can't lie under, this was not that long ago. But you're not obligated to tell them. And yes, if they believe that you're worthy enough and you've passed the test and you did your speeches and you had interviewed and you've passed all the credentials and the community wants you, take the position. So, it appears that we argue that if a person does things when they're younger and they're remorseful and they repent, they can take on a community position.
And that's, I think that's the big question in the Kavanaugh case.
Right, okay, so the Kavanaugh case was, he did not, you know, right. He argues, why should I remorseful? I didn't do anything.
Right, exactly.
So it's not the same thing.
No,
right.
No, I know.
Yes, like, yes, for sure, right? Okay, good. Okay, so that is the first step. That is the first stage.
Kavanaugh was also not convicted.
Like, yeah, he was never convicted. There's nothing. There's no right. Okay, good. Okay, so that's the first step. Meaning, from a what I wanted to demonstrate in this first part is we hold government communal positions very seriously. Does that mean that if you have a black cloud over your head that can never go away? Not necessarily.
But you have to sincerely repent and prove it,
in order to admit. To take this position, as we saw there. Fine. That's step one. Step two. How do we deal with rumors? Let me give you an example. Let's say, and by the way, this is something which, you know, full disclosure, anyone who's involved in education, rabbinic community, has to worry about all the time. One small accusation, you're finished. You're done. It's over. Your life is over. Your years is over. Your job is over. You're over, right? I can go become a plumber. Like, what am I supposed to do? Right? Everything, your reputation is everything. So any blemish to your reputation, you're in big trouble. So if all of a sudden a person comes and says, oh, that rabbi, he did X and Y to me. Or tried to do X and Y. And by the way, that could be a male accusing a male, it could be a female accusing a male, it could be that's not going to matter. Right? Single, married, it's not going to matter. So how do you deal with it? Right, what? What, you should believe every person? So this is a major, major, major issue, especially because we know in Jewish law we have a concept of Lashon Hara. You can't slander people. We're not allowed to slander. But how do you do it? So someone comes to you and says, well, this person did X and X. How are you allowed to say that? And it appears, based on the case that we saw before, what happened with Tuvia, right? Where he said,
so,
Tuvia sinned and Zigu got in trouble. Why?
So, if Zigu had been the victim, would it have been different if he had been the victim of whatever Tuvia did?
Okay.
Hey, he did this to me.
Okay.
Rather than I just saw.
Okay. Mira asked a great question. What about if it happened to him versus that he saw someone else? Very good. Okay. Excellent. So, I just tried to get as clean as possible. So there's the Chavetz Chaim wrote a well-known book on Lashon Hara. And what essentially he says is, if someone comes and says this person does X and Y, we know you're not allowed to accept slanderous speech. We're not allowed to accept slanderous speech. How are you supposed to deal with any type of
allegations?
What? You're not supposed to allegations? And this what comes up is, well, you know why there's only one person? I was alone in a room. So how could there be two witnesses in such a case? How are we going to deal with it? And this is a very real situation, which is not just in the modern era, by the way. This is a case that has gone for hundreds and hundreds of years. How do you deal with allegations when it's impossible to have two witnesses? It was done in private. Right? There's no cameras, there's no... Okay, how do you deal with it? So the Chofetz Chaim says something of tremendous insight. He says, listen... You need to make a distinction. Is this person potentially going to be a repeat offender? If this person could potentially be a repeat offender, and this person goes to their local communal leader and says, that person did this to me. Let's say the person's not even a communal leader, right? Meaning, I'm a communal leader, George comes over to me and says, you should know. Stephen did something totally inappropriate. I, as a communal leader, I am not allowed to necessarily believe that, because that could be slanderous. But if I feel there's a potential for Stephen to hurt others, then, says the Chafetz Chaim, what is my obligation? I need to tell the local court and start an inquiry. And say these allegations are serious. And not only are they serious, but there's a potential for greater harm. We need to inquire. And then he also says that if what someone does something to you, right, and whether it's a leader or not leader, you're always allowed to go to your local rabbinic figure and say, this happened to me. You're not allowed to say it happened to somebody else. But if you're the person who it happened to, you'd be allowed to go to the leader and say, listen, I didn't know the witnesses. It's impossible. There will never be any witnesses. And that's not considered Lashon Hara. Why? Because, now, if it turns out the guy's lying, then of course it is. But, meaning, it's not considered a violation because you, don't look at it as the case of the Gemara Psachim of Zivug Sin and Tuvig is flawed. That's not true. If it happens to you, you'd be allowed to go and report it. Now, he goes on to say, you have to have the right intentions, and you have to be sure, and so, okay, that's I think that's all obvious. But don't consider it as part of Lashon Hara. Okay, now, that's the Chofetz Chaim. On the Shulchan Aruch, in the next stage, says, Ein Mesalkin Chazan Mumanuso. Let's say there's a Chazan, and again, we have a funny time with this, because we don't look at a Chazan in such a communal position today. But there's a cantor, and again, by the way, this is referring to the Tuesday guy, not your Rosh Hashanah guy, right? Your Tuesday guy, because this is the laws of who can serve to lead the service during the week, right? You can't remove him unless Nimsa Bopasol. You find a blemish. Says Ramah, Ve'ein Mesalkin Oto Mishum Ranun Balma. You can't just remove somebody because you hear something. In English, why do they say this? Because of slander, okay? Kigon, She Yatzalav Shem Shinit. That maybe he went around and he was caught with non-Jewish women, right? Or shemasar adam, or he handed over someone to non-Jewish authorities. Witnesses come. Witnesses actually come. We could remove such a person.
So that deals with the post facto, with removing a person from a
yes.
position they already have. How does that relate to a position they have not yet
okay.
acquired?
Excellent. That's exactly what?
Presumably, they wouldn't be allowed in the first place. If they would be removed because of it, presumably that would be disqualifying in the first place.
Okay, so that's why.
But just based on the. I'm saying just based on a rumor. Can you deny a position?
Oh.
Just based
so,
on
okay,
a rumor.
So that's where the language that I said earlier. What was the language there? Ra'ah? What was the language that I had there? Here. Shem. No, that wasn't it. Mishum Rish'ah. Now, Rish'ah means wickedness. So that's going to be a very ambiguous term. We're going to see how it will get defined. I'll explain to you how the post-school later on define it. But you're right. It appears that once they're in the position, we are going to require a higher standard yeah. to remove them versus.
Before they've gotten the job.
Before they've
gotten
the job. So this actually happened in England. In England, the night before, a rabbi was appointed in a very large community. A woman said, he did say to me, which was totally inappropriate. The congregation, well, that's not true, not congregation. The search committee, what was he going to do? He came in, he interviewed, he spoke, he met people, he passed with not flying colors. And literally before they're going to sit down and have a technical vote because everyone knew it was going to be unanimous, all of a sudden this comes out. What do they do? What are they supposed to do? So this happens. This is not a crazy thing. What do you do again with allegations literally on the eve of an appointment of a very serious position? So this was a case in England, and they sent the letter to the famous Rav Menashe Klein. No, I apologize. From Usher Weiss, who's a very well-known contemporary rabbinic figure in the land of Israel. And they asked him, what are we supposed to do? So first thing they did was they pushed out the vote by 48 hours because they needed time to figure this out. Right? What are we supposed to do? There's an allegation. Okay. Says the Mishnah Berurah, because it's exactly this case. You see who says Ayin Hey? Mishnah Berurah. And B, the aim is aval limnoto lechatchila. What about appointing, not post facto but pre facto? Afilu bishvo rinun balma. Even some type of, again, this is very, you know, rinun balma, some type of slander. Prevent, don't do it. Yeshim noa afilu ma rinun haya alav rak build. Even if this rumor was just when he was a little kid, don't do it. Even if he was just a little kid, don't do it.
I guess this is kind of like the Brett Kavanaugh case, exactly.
I mean, that's it.
Okay, so this seems to be, right? So here we go. What do we do now? Here's a person. We don't, should we appoint him? There's this rumor about him when he was younger.
Right. Now, it's also like, we're talking about like how you can't remove it unless there's evidence. Kind of like the same case in like U.S. law, too. Like, it takes a much bigger thing to impeach Brett Kavanaugh versus not to confirm it.
Right.
Yeah, it's going to take, eventually
it's
a two-thirds vote of both.
It's
going
to take a two-thirds vote rather 51 to appoint, which is a lot.
Yeah,
right.
It's a huge difference. And it would take two-thirds of both houses.
Right.
And this is a major impact because we know, because we also know, not just technically, but we also know, to strip someone a position is a much bigger deal than not to give someone a position. That's just a right. That's a, so, and remember, this is about a chazan. This is a guy davening on Tuesday morning, right? Tuesday morning. I don't know why I'm using Tuesday when today's Monday. I'm not quite sure why I'm not using Monday morning. But I'm not. Monday morning quarterback, right? But now he goes on to say, the Mishnah Berurah, and says, what does it mean? Mikom makom, yesh lachush lekol lehoshiv beit din al kacha. Now, if there's a rumor, and this is a very important statement in Jewish law, it's called kol. What is the definition of a kol, which is a rumor, and of what people are coming along and questioning? So the halachic standard is if for 2 days straight the person is being attacked and no one is able to defend him, that, I actually, believe it or not, has tremendous weight in Jewish law.
What
it's
is
called kol.
Defense
is, no, he's a good guy, no way he could have done it. Right? If no one is out there, if no one can say anything good about this person, then maybe this rumor, we have to give it weight.
It seems like a very high standard.
It's a very high standard. It is a very high standard. Yeah, yeah.
It doesn't matter how many people spring to that person's defense. It doesn't matter if they're related or...
Okay, so very good. The Chofetz Chaim, which I skipped on purpose, because I'm going to go back to it after, but since you mentioned it, I'm going to quote it. Take a look at Zion, the second line. Oh, wait a second. So the rabbi is allowed to accept it, but at least you can hate it. Hang on, and to make sure build it. That's not what I wanted to show you. I cut it out. It's in the Chofetz. I remember I took it and I cut out one, and now I realize why I put both in. Because without that one, I don't have what I want to show you. But it actually says, there's a line in there, that when you do an investigation, you have to ask, who is this person who's bringing the allegations? Are they an enemy? Do they have an agenda? Because if they do, their credibility is diminished.
And do you have to ask the same question about the person who's defending the person being accused?
Interesting. He doesn't say that, Chofetz Chaim.
Right. So that's what I find so interesting about the...
Mm-hmm.
It's an assumption that the person standing up to defend is defending honestly because they're putting themselves out there to defend someone who's being accused. And I think that's a very interesting...
Because, again, because we don't... Again, slander is a big deal.
Right.
Right? The burden of proof goes on the person who's... If I was trying to slander you, I better have a reason to. That's, I think, the rationale behind it, right?
But on the flip side of that, it's not... Then what is it to falsely say, no, they couldn't have done this? That doesn't seem to be something.
Okay, so that's where, right, so that's where all the contemporary poskim, and what I was going to say, was if they need to, in the modern era, what they do today, when this happens, is they actually have to appoint a tribunal in order to investigate the allegations. Right? That's actually what happened today. If someone is accused, even individually, there's a tribunal who will take the matter to the next level. Call it FBI investigation.
I was about to say,
you know,
why not an FBI investigation?
Again, it's very complicated because modern-day politics are so caught up in politics versus truth that it's so complicated. But, want to share?
Yeah, I'll look at
that. But that is a major, and it's clear that you need to, if there's somewhat... truth in these allegations, that's what you need to do. Okay. Oh, and this is what's called a kala dula pasak. It's a voice that doesn't end. That's referred to as a, for I don't remember, 36 or 48 hours, that no one's able to say anything. Oh, no, I have it here. I do have it here. V'yad'anu shalav ha'oivim, that they're not the enemies that are doing that. Hold it. Afkula kala. It's not the enemy. No, it's no big deal. If no one likes me, then it's the people I don't like who are saying bad things. Right? That's no secret. That's not helpful. Right? You should know, I had a... this was actually a fascinating case. My son was in an accident a year and a bit ago at the corner of Chabad and Bathurst. My son was going north. See why this is relevant. My son is going north on Bathurst, and a guy is heading south, makes a left, and hits him. So we all know the rule. If you're going straight and you're turning, who's at fault? The guy who turns, right? So my son was hit, and we had many witnesses who were there. This is Chabad and Bathurst in July at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Like, you know, there's like, it's not a lot of people there. Now, it happens to be half the people who are there. We know, because we know a lot of people. But there was one guy who was not Jewish, who lived in Aurora, who was an insurance person, whose name I have on my phone somewhere, who stayed for an hour and a half to 2 hours till the police came and gave an hour explanation about what happened. And he came over to us and said, don't worry, I saw the whole thing, I'll give my testimony. I stayed for like 2 hours, which, by the way, you don't have to do. You can actually give evidence later to the police. You don't. People think you have to stick around. It's actually not true. You can actually just get the information, they can contact them, give a statement later. It doesn't matter. I don't expect you to stay. I mean, the guy's staying for 2 hours. I mean, the guy's working somewhere and he lives out in Aurora and whatever. Very nice of him. But here's what I'm telling the story. The other person we hit, their morals are, shall we say, slightly questioned. Why? Because they said, oh, all these people who were testifying on my son's behalf, oh, you're friends with them. Now, it happened to me there were two people there who were Jewish, who had kippah on their head, who also stuck around. That happened to me that way, but not this guy who's, you know, from like Aurora, who's working in insurance. He's no, you know. And what, when the insurance company came to us later, they said, you know what, those, because we also had people call the police officer, even though the police officer, I remember, and they actually really didn't take the, even though they were there, but because they were males wearing a kippah, their evidence wasn't as strong as that non-Jewish guy from Aurora, right? And then all of a sudden, they're produced a witness from nowhere to say something totally different, which I think, hopefully they were charged. I mean, it was a long time ago, I think I haven't done that, so I'm assuming hopefully they were charged and they were caught with fraud. That's what but you don't find out those things. But they are very fraudulent. That's a different story. So it's true that in the modern, my point of all this is, if it's someone who you're friends with, or your enemy, their credibility, even if they're right, which wasn't our case, is really not going to be taken with nearly as much credence as a total stranger. Isn't that fascinating? Okay. Vafilu yachid yachol lakev. Okay, this is important. Even a single person is able to if he comes, if a single person comes and testifies, and their testimony really is with the proper intent, and they mean it, and there's no reason why they would do it, we need to take what they say very seriously. And then he goes on to say, "V'kol shekvar have you run it? If we've already done it, v'amad kach zman rav, been a long time. V'atar rotzim lachzira. Now you want to point him back? Dino ke hatmanot mitchila." That again, it's as if we're doing it again. I'm going to go through the proper investigation. Ve'im yesh manegim be'ir. This is what I'm interested in. Shebechol yonim shall the ear sumchil lam. There are people. These are leaders. We trust them. They're the ones you need to approve. The guy who davened in shul on a Monday or a Tuesday, which is quite, which is wild. Okay, so the question that we have to deal with is leadership today in the modern era. So Rav Zalman Yechem Goldberg does argue that today no one has the status of Tuvei Ha'ir, that no one has the status of real communal leaders. We just go according to what's called Dina Machusa Dina, that every government official, Jew, non-Jew, has a status of the law of the land as the law, and that's what they go on. They don't have this higher standard of Tovei Ha'ir, that people need to have all these seven qualifications. He says we don't need that in the modern era. Now this, what's the impact of one witness? How do we deal with one witness? So we saw that case in the Gemara in Pesachim, but the truth is, it's not so simple, because in fact, we know that one witness has tremendous power in Jewish law. One, in monetary things, they can force a shua. They can force you to swear. If one witness says, I know you made that deal. I know you didn't pay back that loan. I'm only one witness. So they can't extricate money, but they can force you, deny, to swear. In those days, people actually were scared of swearing. Today, I don't think anyone cares anymore. But in those days, they actually took it quite seriously, in which case, it was actually considered quite powerful. Don't put the forest on my first. Now, what? Yeah, okay. O devar asur vefrushe mi isura. If this person has an ability to have the person stop sinning, meaning
you can say that means not kosher, right?
Right. Oh, so he has an ability to say, and by the way, we have to argue this. This was made with lard and pig. You can't eat this, so therefore, don't eat it. We have to trust people to make such a claim. That's why in the kashrut world, we don't have two people going to places and check. We only have one. Right? It's too high of a standard to have two, so we trust one person when it comes to kosher, not kosher, i.e. this is forbidden, this is permissible. And when it comes to, I make you swear, when it comes to monetary case. So we see that one witness does have a type of power. Next. This is Nefesh HaRav, a Sefer Rav Shechter, describing Rav Soloveitchik. And he said the following, Shemati Matamid Chacham Echad, I heard a story of a Talmud Chacham, Shalot Tzarot Malbayt Shalot. His balabatim driving him nuts in his shul. Sheratzu L'Sulko V'Mashro Sov. They wanted to remove him from his position. Uba V'Hevi Tzaro B'Fnei Rabo. And they went, and this person, this Mr. Goldberg, is driving the rabbi crazy. Rabbi, leave. We don't like you. You're bad. You're terrible. You're incompetent. You're blah, blah, whatever the accusations may be. Not even something which is, God forbid, sexual, right, or inappropriate. When he went to the rabbi said, I can't help you. Why? In order to continue your rabbinic position, the community needs to like you, and the community needs to want you. If your community doesn't want you, doesn't like you, Asur lo lishera mishmat. You cannot continue in your position. You have to, if you are a community leader and no one likes you, then how can you continue being a community leader? Needs what's called dat kahal. You need the backing of the people.
It's the Thomas Jefferson approach to government. It's, if you don't like your government, you have a responsibility, not just a duty to overthrow it. And they have a responsibility to say, okay, we get it. You're done with us. We're going to go away quietly.
Right. Now, no one does that. First of all, not in politics. Right. Yeah. No one does that in the world today. You know, I mean, Tesla is a great example, right? The CEO, Musk.
Elon Musk.
Did I say Musk? Sorry. Musk, whatever. You know, he's, everyone's down. The board, the shareholders, the dead, the lawyers, the stock exchange committee, whatever they're called. No, this is my company. This is who I am. Now, and that's not even like, I'm talking about communal leadership, right? This is like responsibility of money and finances, right? The problem is that, how much more so in a communal position? Listen, at least Elon Musk is going to walk away with hundreds of millions, whatever it is, right? You don't have to worry about him. Even if the stock has gone down a lot, it doesn't matter. He'll be okay. I'm not worried about him. But you know, Rabbi Goldberg does in his position. Rabbi Goldberg is in a very hard time to find another job, right? Yet, without the communal backing, you can't really continue your position. Okay.
What if it's a position in the community that's like everyone would hate, regardless of who has the position?
Yeah, so I'm not still being pulled for the money.
Like, yeah, the executioner.
Yeah.
Right. Wow. Very interesting. No one likes the gabbai. No one likes the... Right, you're saying, on the other hand...
No one likes the tax collector, yeah.
Right, no one likes the tax collector. So here's the thing. I think that's where you have to balance it. Right, that's a great question. But listen, no one is saying that you need to have popularity of 100 to 0. You know, but And again, the problem with this case is that it's only 4 lines, right? You know, what happens if it's split 50-50? So I don't think you'd remove them, right? I don't think that's what the Rav Soloveitchik is arguing, or Rav Schachter is arguing. I think he's talking about a case where literally there's no, you know, again, I don't know what the numbers are, you know, 50-50, 60-40, 30, I don't know what the numbers are. But you need to have some type of communal support in order to be in charge of a community. Like, it's just, also, just practically, you're not going to be very, you know, if no one respects the rabbi, if no one respects the community leader, so then it's pretty ineffective, right? Regardless
of... They might
of,
like them and not respect them.
That's true, actually, right. Well, right.
Right, there's a two.
Yeah.
I mean, but, like, also, like, the thing, the job that like, everybody hates, I think they'd only be fired if they're incompetent, not if they're disliked.
Right, that's also very true.
It's also different.
Right, yes, right. Incompetency is very different than...
So, like, not everyone, you know, like, the president or something, or the prime minister, not everyone thinks, dislikes him, but a lot more people say he's competent.
Listen, you'll never have a political leader. I mean, I shouldn't say never, that's a strong statement. But, you know, in the modern world of government, you know, has there ever been a unanimous president, prime minister?
George Washington,
right? In the last 100 years, has any government, any country, maybe it's a dictator, which is, you know, they only count the votes that they voted for. You know, like, I don't know how to answer that. What?
Kim Jong-un.
Kim Jong-un, right? Everyone voted for him, right? So, okay. I want to end, because this is a fascinating thing, and this is responding to rumors. Again, this is a lady who said, there was a lady comes and says, a man was chasing after me, and he denies the claim. They said the following, that they weren't allowed to believe her. But what did they do to him? They excommunicated this guy from the community. You can't live here anymore, and they excommunicated him, meaning they didn't have enough evidence, but they felt that there might be something, but they couldn't. So they said, you know what? Out. They ostracized him from the community. Now, if it's somebody, of course, who is known to be suspicious, now this is only if it's a one-time thing, if it's someone who's suspicious and there's rumor, such a person, obviously we can deal with, and we set up a court system, and we separate them, we could actually beat them up, and you could do many things to such a person.
Is that not establishing a presumption of guilt?
So that's what everyone asked that question, right? Imagine if there's a rumor. So let's go back to that case. I mentioned a case before where the night before, I didn't give you the answer, right? The night before in England, there before the vote for this rabbi that was going to be a unanimous vote to support, a lady steps forward and says, this rabbi did X. Usher Weiss said, listen, if this is the first time anyone's saying anything, and all of a sudden, right before he gets appointed, someone comes out. Two, everyone likes the guy. He was good. He was thoughtful. And this was everybody, right? No reason to have these allegations. You've done some type of investigation, and there's no reason why any of it is true. There's actually no reason whatsoever not to appoint such a person, right? That's what in England, in fact, and in fact, you know, what happened was 2 or 3 years later, they find out she had vendetta against him, you know, that's why she did what she did. But I think what's important here is a few things. Number one, we take allegations, and I think in the modern world, we take allegations even more seriously than they had to do hundreds of years ago, because that's, I think, the world that we live in. I think that's very important. And you have to balance what this person says and balance the honor and dignity of the person being accused. Now, the challenge is once this person is accused, there's already going to be a major fallout and ramification most of the time. I think that's the reality. And to remove someone from a position clearly is going to require a much higher standard. Not to a point will be a lower standard, but you're still going to need some type of either a call, a voice, some type of more evidence than just this person did it. You know, is there a reason? Do you have evidence? Is there, you know, and again, this person is going to be challenged. Well, why are you saying that? Do you like the person? Do you think that person? Why are you doing it now? Where have you been for 35 years? Because, by the way, according to Jewish law, there's no statute limitation. You know, that's not a Jewish concept. If I steal $1,000 from you, and 70 years later, you're like, you owe me $1,000. Now, it might be hard for you to get that money back because it's been 70 years later. But in theory, what you did 70 years ago, you stole something years ago, you stole all that money, you have to pay it back, right? So if you have your evidence, then the Beit Din could in fact take the money out of my pocket and give it to you. I want to end, which is a fascinating concept, and this is what I mentioned in the beginning, that we, believe it or not, already 1,000 years ago changed almost what the halacha is in the Torah, that we will allow. And this is based on what's called the Takan of the Gaonim. It's called that we will take, again, what's called evidence. Here, Takan HaKadmonim is found in Shulchan Aruch. That yes, a woman cannot testify. That's the last of Shulchan Aruch. She's psula. She's not able to. But comes on the Ramah and says, that's Medina. That's the law. Aval yesh omrim de Takan HaKadmonim hu. There's a place that you don't find men. It's a woman's only place. Right? We don't have any men to testify. Only she knows what happened. Maybe she's the only one in the room. Maybe she's the only one. Of course we trust them. They are trustworthy to testify. So, and that's what I said in the beginning. We trust them as evidence, not as testimony. Right? So again, in the modern world, what's the practical difference? There probably isn't, because the only major difference would be if someone testifies and they were warned, we can put them to death. But since no one's being put to death in the modern era, what's the difference between evidence and testimony? Probably not very much. And that's why evidence of women, that's why today in the Beit, in the Batei Din in Israel, they always accept women's testimony, right? And put it forth as evidence to the judges. They do it all the time. Both in terms of sexual cases, and there's a monitor. I'm the CEO of a company, and you're going to accept my evidence in the court of Jewish law in Israel? That's absurd! It's absurd, so of course they accept it. If there's an expert, a legal expert on a certain matter, and it's her, she's the expert, of course they're going to accept it as evidence, right? She knows what she's saying. Better than most men, which is often the case, right? So that's where, and you know, and again, this is already, the Ran talks about this already 1,000 years old. There's even a case of a king, where a king felt we have to kill certain people under certain cases, you know, in order to kind of uproot evil. So we do know that there's precedence in sometimes doing certain things which are quote-unquote not exactly, shall we say, the Jewish law like we learned them in school, in order to ensure that, because the case of having to have two witnesses who are you know, upstanding, clear, is very, very hard to find. And courts of law are going to often need to enact certain punishments and various things without two witnesses who saw clearly everything. And therefore, they have to use other types of judgment when they render their decisions, always being careful on the evidence and everything around them. The Kavanaugh case, to me, again, from my vantage point, is there's a lot of questions we have to ask, right? Where was she before? Why is she doing it now? Who else is? What's the evidence? Who's the evidence? And in the world of politics, let's face it, there's no honesty. There's backstabbing. And that's what's so sad about the whole case. But I don't want to deal with the political ramifications to it. I think from our perspective, we have to be more concerned about our reputations and to be serious about what we do and what we say, and try to protect people who need to be protected. And those people, and it shouldn't be that we're out there to help perpetrators, really we should be trying to help those people who are in fact themselves the victims. And I think that's also very important. That's our responsibility. Okay, we'll end there.
In Gideon, there's a little bit of a rather cool whether they were